It's a true honor for me to give one of the Steelman lectures at Wake Forest University, and for several reasons. First, there is the prestige of the Steelman lectures themselves, the status and stature of previous lectures, and likewise the renown of this university and its divinity school. Second, it is a joy for me to return to Wake Forest to see friends again and to engage with you in questions that demand careful thought and conscientious action. Finally, this is your convocation, and so it's a special honor for me to be able to join you at the beginning of the year. I was delighted when Dean O'Day invited me to give this lecture and her gracious introduction as well. I'm glad the day has finally arrived. Thank you again for this honor and also for coming today. Given the scope of the topic, I can assure you that I will be done with this lecture in 4 to 5 hours. Are religious convictions bad for the planet? The title of my lecture might seem a bit odd for a Steelman lecture and the Divinity School's convocation. Yet there's plenty of evidence that the religions are bad for the planet. There are religious beliefs that seem to devalue the natural world just as a waiting station for heaven. Think of Christians who anticipate the white-throned judgment or believe the Left Behind series. Some Christians, especially in the American context, attack as sinful the hard-won advances of the natural and social sciences that push back ignorance, relieve suffering, and warn us of environmental crises. Some Muslim fundamentalists become suicide bombers, hoping for reward in heaven. In Buddhism, despite the need to relieve the suffering of sentient beings, there is the conviction that reality as we know it, the realm of samsara, exists because of wrongful desire. The Buddhist path aims at enlightenment, that is, escape from suffering, but from existence as well. Daily newspapers, blogs, and websites are filled with images of religious conflict and violence around the world. The destructive power of the religions seems endless and relentless. But the destructive force of religion is not the whole story. The religions also do a lot of good on this little planet of ours. Defenders of religion rightly extol its virtues and the claim that religion fosters respect and reverence for life. Many advocates of religion, therefore, place the blame for our social ill on the Enlightenment or capitalism or nationalism and colonialism wrapped in religious garb. There are also Christian theologians who argue that God's economy is one of abundance and not scarcity, and so the church offers a view of life shockingly different than the sinful world where conflict over scarce resources prevails. If we were to reverence nature and see God's abundance around us, then the ecological and social problems we face could be solved. Or so the argument goes. Now, the fact that I'm posing the question of the impact of religious conviction on the planet might lead you to expect from me either a resounding yes or a defensive no to the title. I don't mean to disappoint you, but I will not offer you either any simple yes or no to the title's question. Any short answer, in my judgment, has to be yes, sometimes, but not necessarily so. As practiced by human beings, religions are essentially ambiguous. And given the ambiguity of the religions, choices must be made about how to interpret and to live our traditions. And if that is the case, and I judge it to be the case, then we need an ethics of religious convictions. Can we form an ethics for how we should live our religious lives in an age of environmental endangerment? And if we can, does that mean that religion, despite what many people think, is not the source of morality? Conversely, if religion is the source of morality, can we ever make judgments about what seems to be irresponsible, even evil, ways of being religious? As scholars and religious leaders and pastors, we need to have the courage to tackle rather than to evade those questions. Moral religion, I will argue, is what respects and enhances the integrity of life. Immoral religion, in fact, any immoral action, destroys natural moral and spiritual integrity. Now, on the way to those claims, my reflections move in three big steps, about an hour for each step. Three big steps. First, we need to get some clarity about the subject of these reflections, its form, and the perspective adopted in our argument. Second, I want to engage two types of criticism of religious convictions on planetary life. Learning from, but also responding to, the critics, the third and final step of this lecture is to outline an ethics of religious convictions drawn from the Christian tradition. What we are exploring is human responsibility for the integrity of life as a way of being religious. So first, let me specify the subject of these reflections. A salient feature of our age is the new, if not always seen, fact that virtually every form of life on this planet is endangered because of changes in human action, especially the increase of human power through technology. The revolution in human action reaches back to the 15th or 16th century in the West, and it is now accelerating in rates around the world. The advances in science, medicine, communication, and democratic revolutions have relieved human suffering and oppression. Yet from climate change to interventions in genetics, ecological disaster like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, to the manipulations of diseases, from WikiLeaks to glitches in financial systems, the consequences of human action reach into the future in ways that can threaten human and non-human life. The expansion of human power has made life itself and its vulnerability basic to ethics. And it also makes the idea of responsibility central, since responsibility is about the use of power in complex systems. Now, of course, a fuller treatment of our subject would have to show and chart the interactions among ecosystems, social forms, economic realities, political existence, and the expansion of human power. We know that social injustice is ecologically damaging. By the same token, ecological disasters bring social disorders and economic problems. So while I'm focusing on ecological matters, it is vital to realize that such a focus is actually an abstraction. That is, for the purpose of this lecture, I'm bracketing other factors, say economic and political ones, in order to get at our topic, namely an ethics of religious commitment. The question then is, what is the form of this type of thinking? The title of my lecture poses a question which presupposes that any serious answer to it will be a normative and evaluative one. It is asking if religions are bad in a moral sense as opposed to some other sense. We are not asking, for instance, if religious beliefs and practices are economically beneficial or not, although one could ask that question. The form of thinking is ethical. We will explore and assess the fabric of beliefs, practices, and experiences that people use and ought to use to understand and orient their lives. However, we're looking for an ethics of religious convictions, and so we have to clarify what a conviction is and why are they religious. On my account, conviction has two meanings. First, a conviction is the act and state of being convinced by, being strongly persuaded of, the truth of a belief, and to announce that in one's own life. Conviction in this sense is a reason for action that is open to ethical assessment. The conviction that God is love, for instance, means that one is convinced about how one should act and so has reasons for living in a loving way. Second, conviction also denotes that one is claimed by one's religious beliefs and convicted by them. If you believe that God is love and yet live in unloving ways, then your conviction should convict you and your actions as wrong, as unloving. Both senses of conviction, I'll argue later, are found in the call of conscience. and they are related to the integrity of life as the moral and religious good disclosed in the story of creation. What we're headed towards is the relationship between conscience and creation. But again, we're interested in religious convictions and not other kinds, say political or aesthetic convictions. And as the scholars and students of Wake Forest Divinity School know all too well, there are endless debates about how to define religion. For the sake of this argument, religion, I contend, is a social form defined by, first, convictions, practices, symbolic resources, experiences, and forms of authority that, second, connect human beings to what is most important and most real in ways that, third, empower and orient human lives and human communities. Something might be absolutely real to us, say the fact of adding 2 + 2 = 4, or the chairs you're sitting on today, but not be ultimately important. Something might be ultimately important to you, say the meaning and worth of life or your loved ones, but not be ultimately real. We will die, so too will our loved ones. Further, something might be important, ultimately important and ultimately real, and yet be inaccessible to human beings. We would have no way to be empowered and oriented in our lives by it. Religion is about connection to some power, whether God or the gods or some non-theistic conception, say Dharma, that is ultimately real and ultimately important in the empowerment and orientation of human lives. And it is a connection to that power that exceeds or transcends other ways human beings relate to what is real and what is important for them. In other words, the gist of religion is the human relation to the divine or sacred that empowers and orients individual and communal life. And this is the crucial thing to say and see. Because we live in an age of the expansion of human power, my first point, and religion is also about sacred power and connections to sacred power. This nexus between human and sacred power is at the core of the kind of ethics we're seeking to outline today. One last remark before we turn to the critics of religion. There are, we should note, at least 2 related but different perspectives we could adopt in answering the question of this lecture's title. We could take a perspective outside of any religion and so, say, a purely philosophical, sociological, historical, or even a biological perspective. Ask about the God gene. However, one can also adopt a stance inside a religion, and so from the perspective of faith and religious practice. Here, one is a participant rather than a spectator. The argument I'm presenting today hovers on the boundary between the inside and the outside, between the participant and the spectator. And we should adopt that perspective because we share this fragile planet with others who do not share our beliefs or ways of life, and yet we have to make judgments about our own and others' lives. So the kind of thinking I want us to practice today is a rather difficult one. It is the work of theological ethics that interprets and draws on, but is not solely determined by, the resources of one's religious tradition, Christianity in my case. So hopefully we now have some clarity about the subject, form, and perspective of what we're engaged in today. We are interested in human and divine power within ethical thinking on the boundary between inside and outside perspectives on religion. Our aim is to outline an ethics of religious conviction focused on responsibility for the integrity of life. And the next step in that direction is to consider the arguments of those who insist that religion is very bad indeed for the planet. In highly polarized societies like ours, there are those who believe that religion is evil and a deceptive force in human affairs, and accordingly, it's obviously bad for the planet and human life. I want to explore two different versions of this criticism of religion. One is championed by the so-called new atheists. The second version focuses on religion as a framework of meaning and value. Let's look at these. In his book, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomena, the philosopher Daniel C. Dennett writes that religion is a social system, quote, this is very important, quote, this is his definition of religion, quote, is a social system whose participants avow belief in a supernatural agent or agents whose approval is being sought, unquote. That is, religion is belief in some supernatural being, God, who acts to reward and punish people, and who is in control of reality. Consider, for instance, the penchant of some American politicians and preachers to insist that hurricanes, earthquakes, HIV/AIDS are the judgments of God on the sins of the nation. Saw this recently in our newspapers. Religious convictions these folks hold are like scientific statements. That is, they appear to be factual statements about states of affairs, say the existence of God or the world or human destiny. Dennett's point is that appearances are deceptive. Religious claims cannot meet the demands of scientific method. They lack truth value. Now, Dennett's definition is part of a long-standing idea that religion is supernatural theism, and so belief in some transcendent God or gods. Importantly, his claim is that religion is both deceptive and immoral. Religion is immoral because people do what is good, right, or just for the sake of getting some reward, say to save their souls. But to do an action because one believes one might be rewarded or punished for it is to act from self-interested motives that are ethically questionable. We should do what is right because it is right, and not to get some reward from it. In fact, sometimes doing the right thing can be very costly to one's life. Remember Martin Luther King Jr. or Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Religion is also deceptive, the criticism goes on, because the supernatural agent must reveal truths about reality that normal reason and scientific inquiry cannot know or assess. One simply has to believe in revealed truths as factual statements based on the authority of the religion, even if they run counter to our best knowledge of reality. So, Christians are told they must deny the truth of evolution or the Big Bang because the Bible seems to say, that a supernatural agent called God made the world in 7 days. That belief pits religion against science, meaning by science simply the whole domain of human reason and knowledge. This kind of critic, with a resounding yes to the title of my lecture, is neatly summarized in a statement by Steven Pinker, a psychologist at Harvard. He writes the following. Traditionally, belief in God was attractive because it promised to explain the deepest puzzles about origins. Where did the world come from? What is the basis of life? How can mind arise from body? Why should anyone be moral? Yet over the millennia, he continues, there's been a trend. The deeper we probe these questions and the more we learn about the world in which we live, the less reason there is to believe in God. Now, on this account, belief in a supernatural God then will eventually be surpassed by how we understand the world and morality as well. Now, what this kind of critic of supernatural claims, holding that they are immoral and deceptive, too often seldom face is, as Bernard Williams has noted, quote, an immediate consequence of their own views, that this terrible thing, religion, is a human creation. To be thorough, this line of criticism then should explain why it is that human beings continue to need religious beliefs and practices. Then it answers in two ways. First, like some Enlightenment thinkers, he finds the need for religion in human fear, hope, and the desire for an explanation to suffering and loss. But second, he also thinks, along with Richard Dawkins, that there are cultural replicators analogous to genes in biology. cultural memes, as they call this, pass down ideas and values in ways not always perceived or understood. In order to break the spell of religion, one needs to isolate and root out these memes that transmit religion in culture and society. And that is one job of science. Now, the argument given by Dennett and others raises basic issues for the kind of thinking we are trying to do today. This is why I'm engaging these two types of criticism. A long-standing idea is that morality is dependent upon the will and command of a supernatural God. What we mean by right and wrong is just what God commands, say, the Ten Commandments, or Christians' understanding of the double love command, or in the Quran and Islamic law, or Sharia. And while divine command ethics has received some attention in recent philosophy and theology, it has been criticized on three fronts that parallel the criticism of supernaturalism I just went through. One, how do I know that it is God that commands me and not, say, my own mind or my community's leaders? Two, what if God commands something that runs against our usual moral judgment, say that God's will is that his people slay the ungodly? Or third, what if God seems to command contradictory things? I am commanded to love my neighbor and to resist sinners, but everyone's a sinner and also my neighbor. So basing ethics on divine command runs into problems about religious knowledge, moral standards, and consistency in moral judgments. Now, it's very important to know that divine command ethics, rooted in a supernatural idea of God, is not the only form of ethics found in the religious traditions. And we have to claim the freedom within our traditions to think and live otherwise. One counterargument to divine command ethics finds the origins of morality in human reason. Another type finds morality rooted in fundamental intuitions about what is right or wrong, good or bad. And still others appeal to nature, say the evolution of human beings as moral creatures. There's a biological roots there to morality. No less than Charles Darwin noted the following, quote, "Of all the differences between man and the lower animals, the moral sense or conscience is by far the most important. It is the most noble of all attributes of man, leading him without a moment's hesitation to risk his life for that of his fellow creature, or after due deliberation, impelled simply by the deep feeling of right or duty, to sacrifice himself in some great cause." Now, if that is the case, that is, that our moral capacities arise within the natural evolution of a species, then any account of morality rooted in supernatural divine commands is dangerous for the planet. It must be, per definition, because it denies the natural roots of morality in our species. Now, my job is not to criticize these theories or to assess them, which is not possible in this lecture, but if we listen to the critics, we can learn something about problems in various conceptions of the connection between religion and morality. And one might conclude, as I have, that we have the freedom and responsibility to think differently about how we hold our religious convictions. Divine command ethics is not the only way to think about the connection between religion and morality in the monotheistic tradition. Jews talk about the covenant with Noah after the flood, which asserts that every human being has some natural sense of right and wrong. Muslims make a similar claim, and so do Christians in the idea of natural law. I'm going to be returning to this later. It's important for what I want to say about the place of conscience in an ethics of religious convictions. In any case, one resounding yes to the title of this lecture focuses on theistic beliefs as immoral and intellectually outdated. Beliefs in the man upstairs, to use the popular term. Believers, religious thinkers, scholars need to articulate the complexity and abiding insight of religious traditions over and against simple if extremely popular, supernaturalist ideas of God and their critics. Consider now a second yes to the title of the lecture. I should note here, what I'm trying to do is to take my adversaries very seriously and learn from them, because I think that's part of what we have to do as religious scholars and leaders. This second line of thinking is not focused on theistic convictions, but on a whole evaluative framework, an axiology. Many people hold that the religions are rabidly anthropocentric, that is, they make human beings the highest value and devalue non-human life. Religion thereby fosters disregard for the planet's ecosystem and non-human life, and this is especially true, so the argument goes, with Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Made famous in a 1967 article by Lynn White entitled "The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis," the charge is that these religions allow and in fact demand the subjugation of the natural world for the sake of our benefit. After all, an account of creation in Genesis seems to give human beings domination over the earth. What is more, ideas about heaven, salvation, and damnation mean that the finite world is seen as somehow of less value than non-finite life. The 19th century philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche saw in biblical religion a servile life marked by a hatred of finite existence and the will to live. What he called nihilism is a perspective which values finite life only if it's related to something that is non-finite, that is infinite. And that means a certain hatred of life, a no-saying, as he called it. Nietzsche sought a yes-saying to reality despite the pain, suffering, and waste when natural life struggles with natural life. Now, the insight of Nietzsche and Lynn White is that beliefs, like belief in the supernatural God, as well as knowledge itself, and so science in the widest sense of the term, always depend on what we value, the background assumptions of our lives, out of which certain beliefs and forms of knowledge arise and in which they cohere. Cultures and religions, then, are symbolic frameworks for human life. The philosopher Mary Midgley has noted, quote, "These frameworks are imaginative patterns, networks of powerful symbols that suggest particular ways of interpreting the world," unquote. Religions link various symbols and practices with a vision of reality and motivate human action. Now, this account of religion is much more complex than saying religion is belief in a supernatural being. On the second account, religion can take many forms, but at root, it's a framework of values. And in this light, we can grasp the real force of White's and Nietzsche's resounding yes to the title of my lecture. A religious outlook seems to entail a whole worldview that is either anthropocentric and thus warrants our domination of the natural world, or it is nihilistic, and so the denial of the value of finite life. If that is true, then religious convictions are very bad indeed for the planet, and we ought to reject them. The problem is that religious convictions are part of the deep structure, the tenacious assumptions of our civilization, used to understand reality and to shape consciousness. Isolating and rejecting every one of these assumptions is almost an impossible task. In fact, Nietzsche thought we needed a whole new kind of human being, what he called the Übermensch. Others insist that we have to reject completely the biblical heritages. But can we even conceive what our lives would be like if we could pick out and reject every background assumption and its relation to religion about what is valuable and meaningful? So this line of criticism looks to human consciousness to find the origins of ethics. More than anything else, it's contending human beings are evaluators. We make sense of our lives, actions, and social relations in terms of what is better and worse, good and bad. Moral ideas are not read off the natural features of living or non-living things. That is, I do not look at something imagine the glorious ecosystem of the sugar cane of lakes in the Northwoods in Wisconsin. I don't look at that and then somehow deduce the meaning of good and bad, right and wrong. Rather, human consciousness organizes our experiences in those terms. To be sure, we believe that our evaluations are linked to their object in some way, but it's not a linkage of simple dependence. As Plato would put it, we see reality in the light of the good. That is, values are like the sun that allow us to see and to evaluate some things in a way believed to be truer than some other way. I am convinced that my judgment of the goodness of the ecosystem of the sugar camp chain is truer than seeing the lakes in terms of monetary value. My response to the developer who wants to deforest the lakeside would have to be, in part, look again. The challenge is to clarify our moral vision in order to rid ourselves of what blocks us to truthful perceptions of reality. As St. Augustine might put it, only when we love correctly, when we love and enjoy God and all things through God, is our life rightly and truthfully ordered. The critic's worry is that the love of God entails seeing planetary life solely for human purposes, and so anthropocentric, or, as Nietzsche has it, the love of God devalues finite life. At stake is not divine command ethics, but creation as a framework of values. Now we have to ask, is it really the case that the monotheistic religions are obviously and only anthropocentric and nihilistic? Here too, it seems to me, we must answer, yes, sometimes, but not necessarily so. No doubt some Christians, Jews, and Muslims understand their faith in anthropocentric ways, even nihilistic ways, and orient their lives in those terms. But it is important to see that the Genesis story in the Christian and Jewish Bibles is a creation myth that can be read in other ways. Two points are particularly important. First, by means of the days of creation, this story depicts human beings set amid complex realities of different times, forms of life, rhythms and patterns of nature. There is the time of light and dark, day and night, but also the span of mortal life, distinct from the time of God's action. The divine blessing is poured out on creatures, human beings, and even the Sabbath. Creation is the interaction, then, of natural and social cultural processes, not just night and day, but also the naming of creatures. And each of those have their own distinctive dynamics. This is hardly the picture of a human tyrannical domination of nature. Second, this complex reality is called good by the divine, and God saw that it was good. Worth or value inheres in created things and can be recognized by God, and God's recognition, differently than ours, is also creative of worth. The finite world is not devalued because it is finite. In fact, God blesses creation and then rests in its completion. The creation story is a myth of world construction in which blessing and not domination is really the key to understanding reality. This insight culminates in the narrative of Noah and the flood. After destroying the world because of human evil, God the warrior hangs his bow in the heavens and makes a covenant to sustain life. Throughout the biblical text in their canonical form is an ongoing tension between God as righteous but wrathful judge and God as sustainer and redeemer of life. Much like the alternatives to divine command ethics, there is also in these traditions perceptions of reality that are non-anthropocentric, non-nihilistic. Which interpretation of the biblical sources will inform our own lives? So I've isolated two types of yes answer to the leading question of this lecture. One type defines religion in terms of belief in a supernatural agent and then seeks to isolate its moral and intellectual dangers. The other type sees religion more in terms of background assumptions about meaning and value in the whole symbolic framework of a civilization within which life is then lived and interpreted. I should also note that each of these criticisms has been made from within the faith community. Theologian James Gustafson, for instance, has challenged the anthropocentric faith from the perspective of a theocentric ethics, in which one is to consent to the divine powers that bear down and sustain life, realizing that God is not a servant of the human heart. Others, like Sally McFaig and Gordon Kaufman, have tried to reconstruct metaphors and concepts of God in ways that value the natural world, or, as McFaig puts it, seeing nature as the body of God. And there's a long tradition of criticizing theistic ideas of God as a supernatural being that run from ancient thinkers all the way up into contemporary thought. How to respond, then, to the arguments that religion is simply and solely bad for the planet? I want now to outline a position that can engage the critics on two interlocking levels of thought that we've isolated: moral knowledge and the domain of value. My task here is trying to develop an ethics of conviction amid the expansion of human power. So we now move into the third hour of this lecture. We have seen that the question about religion and our fragile planet is at root not about religion or about the planet. It's about human beings and how they interpret their religious convictions. In all honesty, there are supernatural, nihilistic, and anthropocentric forms of religion. But that is not the only meaning of religion or how religion is lived. Because we've isolated non-supernatural, non-anthropocentric, and non-nihilist forms as well. The challenge before us is the orientation of human power in relation to interdependent realms of life on our planet. Can we hold convictions about God's creative and redemptive power in ways that provide responsible orientation for human power? I've already intimated two crucial aspects of such an ethics. One aspect is a claim about human beings as moral agents, that is, as beings who act and suffer in complex relations to social and natural environments. I noted that we needed an alternative to divine command ethics, that is, we need a moral outlook that insists that every human being has some basic moral knowledge. Jews talk about this in terms of the covenant with Noah, Muslims through ideas about justice, but in the Christian tradition, it is conceived in terms of natural law and, importantly, conscience. Even Darwin, we saw, recognizes that conscience is a distinctive characteristic of human beings. Conscience then provides a way to understand the biological conditions of moral agency, but also the distinctive human capacity to wonder about, assess, and direct our actions and relations. Morality is not some otherworldly facet of our being dictated by a supernatural commander, but rather the point of our relation and yet distinctiveness from other forms of life on this planet. The sense of responsibility, that is, the claim to respect and enhance the integrity of life, is the call of conscience. Now, a lot more could be said about conscience. We could, for instance, examine the ways conscience is formed and even deformed by the communities in which we exist, including families and religious communities. We could explore the failure of conscience, part of what Christians call the presence of sin in our lives, and also the crossing point between biology and psychology, or the origins of conscience. The work of conscience, we would have to show, is the challenge and joy of the moral life itself. All of that's not possible in this lecture, I'm sure you're glad to hear. Still, the religions, and in this case Christianity, have ways to speak about moral knowledge that do not rely upon supernatural commands of God that so often lead religious action into being dangerous for the planet. This does not mean that conscience is not a religious idea. On the contrary, There is a long history of reflection on conscience that speaks of it as the voice of God in the soul, a divine spark, or as John Calvin put it, a sense of the divine. A Christian theological ethicist, then, can speak about moral knowledge and the human relationship to the divine in ways that are distinctive from, but cohere with, scientific accounts about the origins of morality. One sees that our moral capacities link us to other forms of life, and hopefully then we are less inclined to interpret our traditions in supernaturalistic, anthropocentric, or nihilistic ways. Indeed, the call of conscience in our global age is precisely that we can and ought to respect and enhance the integrity of forms of life on this very fragile planet of ours. As I said earlier in this lecture, immoral religion thwarts the flourishing of life, and it destroys moral and spiritual integrity. Immoral religion, we now can say, violates conscience and the call to responsibility. So one part of the ethics of religious conviction is found in the thickly textured idea of conscience as a way to describe moral knowledge. There's a second and related part to the answer, and it concerns the domain of value and responds to the second line of criticism of religion. The creation story we saw can be interpreted as integrating complex natural and social processes rather than asserting that human beings have simple domination over all other forms of life. Because of this, I've spoken in terms of the integrity of life, and the reason for this focus on life is both theological and ethical. William James, the great American philosopher, once wrote the following, quote, "Life, more life, a larger, richer, more satisfying life, is, in last analysis, the end of religion. The love of life, at any and every level of development, is the religious impulse," unquote. James, I think, is only partly right. The idea of life provides a way to conceive of the connection and yet difference between dimensions of reality: divine life, planetary life, human life, social life, sentient life. But life is not a second God. Rather, it is modalities of connection among dimensions of reality, including God. This is why Christians speak about the need to, quote, walk in the ways that lead to life, and more importantly, hope in new life. This is not a subtle form of nihilism. It is, in fact, a way to articulate the worth and dignity of finite life as a mode of connection to other forms of life. For human beings, finite life is the modality of right and good connections to the divine life when it is oriented to what respects and enhances the integrity of life. In a word, the ethics of religious conviction is at root about a mode of human life, responsibility for the integrity of life, that relates human power to divine power. No less than St. Augustine, in the Confessions, spoke of God as the life of his life. Yet we are to respect and enhance not just life as the dynamic interconnection between levels of reality, but the integrity of life. Life is not an absolute value. That's where James erred in his argument. At times it is justified to take life, and in any case, in our world, life competes with life. What the idea of integrity adds to thinking is that we are to respect and enhance the integration of goods needed for a form of life to flourish. And here, too, more needs to be said than I can say in one short 4-hour lecture. We would need to explore kinds of basic social, reflexive, and local goods that have to be integrated for life to flourish on our planet. And we'd have to ponder the ways in which the disintegration of those goods and their relations is precisely the ecological, social, political, economic, and cultural crises we now face. The idea of integrity, furthermore, is not only about living beings, but so too non-living realities that are ingredients of and environments for living beings, the starry heavens above, the sands along the beach, the seas and the lands. These are valued in relation to to living things, including the living God. And living things, we should note, cannot endure or flourish without them. If that is correct, then religious convictions that lead to actions and policies of disintegration are immoral and irresponsible. We are free to hold religious convictions in ways that respect and enhance, rather than demean and destroy, the integrity of life. Now, what I have just attempted is to reconstruct religious convictions in light of two widespread criticisms of religion and its impact on the planet, leveled from outside perspectives. Please note that I've done so by reclaiming and reinterpreting ideas about conscience and creation found inside the Christian tradition, but that resonate with outside perspectives. I have sought to enact a style of thinking about religious life that arises from within a tradition and yet can and must meet the demands of the call of responsibility for our interaction with the planet, its ecosystem, and future human life. I hope you have been persuaded that this kind of critical, reconstructive thinking on the boundaries of the inside and the outside is the pressing task of religious leadership and thinking in our time. I leave it to thinkers in other traditions to undertake the same kind of work for their communities, as I've done for the Christian communities. So now, having made a case that religion is not necessarily bad for the planet, let me conclude on a somewhat different point. The twists and turns of this lecture have shown how the religions are massive, complex forces of civilization, but sadly also sometimes barbarism. While too often the religions ignite the fires of hatred, wanton self-interest, and ignorance, they are also storehouses of wisdom that inspire the minds and hearts of people the world over and throughout the ages. It is the ambiguity of religious convictions that scholars, students, and believers must confront and seek to reconstruct in the light of their most responsible and humane insights. Mindful of the ecological, social, and cultural perils, even crises of our age, responsibility for the integrity of life provides the framework for an ethics of religious convictions, how we hold our religious beliefs. And it is very vital, I believe, to note the challenge we face about the nature and aim of religious convictions at the beginning of an academic year. Because what has been set before us, to recall the ancient words of Deuteronomy, is life and death. Let us choose to inhabit freely and responsibly our religious convictions so that future generations and our fragile planet might live. Those convictions must become reasons for individual and communal action, and thus the call of conscience in our global age. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.